Session number 23218, Reel 4.
Carl Goodmanset, Reel 4. You were saying that the local police went to the commando camp and recommended them to get out.
Get out. So they did and got back. And this New Zealand young officer, he was so keen that he was able to organize another raid later, led by himself and the Motodori, and which was a complete failure. He was caught and executed after being brought to a German prison camp. But then this was the first winter. Then, you know, when the summer came, then it was impossible to operate through Shetland.
Why was that?
Because the light. We had to have... To get into the Norwegian coast, you have to come in the darkness. Otherwise, you haven't got the chance, because it's light all through the night up there in the summer, you know.
How much darkness do you need? How many hours of darkness would make it viable to operate?
Yeah, you have to have at least 4 hours.
Yes.
Yeah. First, to have the 4 hours, you must first get in, so you have to get possibility when you're getting out. But then, in the summertime, then we did special training, because we left Shetland and went down. We have now got our base in Eastbourne.
Eastbourne, that's a bit of a change from the Shetlands.
We went from Wales to Shetland and then back to. So for the rest of the war, Eastbourne became our base. Mm. And then from Eastbourne during the summertime, we did special operations then. We did what was called rock salt climbing. We were stationed in the boat special boat section school in St Ives in Cornwall, and did climbing on the cliffs on the Land's End. Then we operated with small dories and approached the cliffs, jumped the shore on the cliffs, and climbed the cliffs on top to attack what was on the top of the cliffs.
How many men would you get in one of these small dories?
Ten persons.
It's like a tiny assault craft.
It's a small motor dory with a straight large motor. According to that boat, the motor behind this is very, 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 very large.
Yes.
So we approach the cliffs, use the waves, and jump when time is there, and clang a clip onto the cliff. And climb up and attack what's on the top. The reasons behind that training, which we did 2 summers, became evident then we know afterwards, because the plan was that when the invasion came, there was needing the Allied forces needed a supply harbor, and they planned to capture Cherbourg. But if they had captured Cherbourg for supply harbor, they must have been attacking the shore batteries on the northern Channel Islands, because they could then harass the traffic to the Cherbourg those big batteries if they came to that area. No, that later it will show that, you know, that the capture harbour never gone through, because when they eventually captured harbour Cherbourg, too late, it was unusable for traffic of any sort for months to come. But then when the next winter came, that was winter 44-45, the whole of number 5 troop was sent to Shetland.
Yeah.
And then we operated on a completely other thing. We operated together with number 51 Norwegian MTB squadron. And they operated on the Norwegian coast. It was always normally minimum two MTBs. MTBs together.
And how many men?
And then when normally then we had 4 commanders on each MTB and 1 officer for the 2 MTBs. One was chieftain.
Team of 9.
Yeah. And then we went in the darkness, found a hiding place along an island or in the fjord, where we camouflaged the MTBs in the short side and waited for things to come along the fjord, along the coast, to torpedo that. At that time, then the commando group has to establish watch on the land and observation posts on the land. And the whole of the winter on each of those ranges, there were lots of raids and so on. All the personnel in number 10 Commander 5 Troop did one or two of those raids on the Norwegian coast.
How did you actually camouflage the MTB?
We had big camouflage nets where we hang from the cliffs over the boat out to the seaside. Well, that goes fairly quickly.
Now, how far inland would you go to establish your...
Now, we have to be at the places where we can see the ship route outside, you know. Mm. So we have lots of small islands, and we could also be inside an island on the Malta side. I have observation on the top on the island to see what's going on. And a lot of shipping was sunk, of course. But we had no accident on that one. Quite a lot of very, very heavy seed back from the job. I can tell you that one MTB, the group came back to Shetland, they also said that they have pumped the North Sea twice through the boat. And the boat, when they got onto the quay at Lerwick, and the shore, the personnel went ashore, the boat sunk.
Immediately?
Yeah. You know, it was wooden boats. So plywood is made of it. Yeah.
Did you have any contact with the German army or air force or navy while you were on these raids?
Of course, some of the raids got into air contact with attacking planes, but no, there was no casualties so far with that. But we had no contact with the Germans on land. No.
What about German naval craft? Do you have any?
Yes, they took up, they sank a German destroyer once. Oh. Another strange thing also was they collected Christmas tree every year for our king. So that was the Shetland operation, actually. And we were stationed in Shetland in May 44, when the invasion was imminent. And then the end of May, we were brought down to Eastbourne. In 44, ready for we thought was the invasion, but we were reserved in Eastbourne, waiting eventually to be used along the Channel Island if that was necessary.
So would you have been attacking Alderney?
Alderney, yes.
That would have been the main target.
Yeah.
I mean, did you know that at the time?
No.
You didn't?
That was a secret.
So you weren't briefed for...
No. Our boss was briefed. Mm. He knew about it.
But Alderney was very, very heavily defended, wasn't it?
Yes, of course.
It would have been a formidable task to...
I think we were studying Alderney from air photos and so on, you know. And I think it would have been a very, very difficult operation.
There were plans at one time to try and make parachute attacks on Alderney.
Yeah.
And they conducted quite a lot of experiments, and they decided that if they did, they'd only get about one third of the men landing on the island.
Yes.
Most.
Because, you know, they didn't have parachute as they have today.
No,
you
they couldn't steer the parachute.
No.
So they thought that, you know, two thirds of the men they dropped would fall into the sea.
Which
would have
been course.
Very.
Yeah. Yes.
A
so
very
that
high
was
price
impossible.
To pay.
Yeah. No. Okay,
You didn't actually go to the Channel Islands operation, did you?
No. We were then waiting in Eastbourne, and that was, of course, very frustrating.
I was going to ask if you were made bored and miserable because you weren't in the invasion.
Yes, of course. Nobody told us eventually why we have to go in Eastbourne, and we were not allowed to go on leave. We were not allowed to talk about anything about what our plans were and so on. And then eventually the first day of it, I think it was around first day of September, suddenly became ordered that we're going to go to Normandy. And then we were brought over to Tilbury Docks and sent over to Armagh. There we landed and we stayed about a week in the assembly area in Armagh area in Normandy.
What What impression did you get of the Mulberry Harbour when you came in?
Very impressive. I think it was very impressive. And first of all, not only the Mulberry Harbour, but also the molo they have built from ship that ordered to sink themselves, you know, to have a breakwater in front of the Mulberry Harbour. And we actually saw the landing of the ship coming in on high water, water moving down, and then they stood dry on the sand, bringing the heavy material land. That was very, very impressive. And of course, then some of them had to put on to the Marlborough, being brought ashore that way. But, you know, it's also very, very impressive that Marlborough Harbour was able to supply the whole forces on the continent all the way till the end of November. That is when they could start using Antwerp. Think of that. If you realize that long supply route all the way up to the middle of Holland, and the number of trucks needed, and not only that way, but also down to the to the south of France, more or less, and over to the far away into Germany on the southern part, patents movement and so on.
How did you get from Tilbury to Arromanches? What sort of vessel did you go in when you sailed across?
It was a normal merchant vessel.
A merchant vessel. Yeah. Did you land on the Mulberry yourself, or were you?
We landed on Mulberry.
On the Mulberry.
Yeah. And went to Jordan. Mm. And then we moved up to Brugge in Belgium. Mm.
To Bruges.
Bruges.
What sort of accommodation did you have when you were in Normandy in the assembly area?
In assembly, we lived in tents.
Right.
Yeah. There's a big tent camp there. Mm.
And do you remember where that was? Any idea of the place?
The name, I don't remember. But,
how long were you there? Were you?
I would say about 3 or 4 days.
Did you see anything of the local French population while you were?
I will tell you a very, very sweet story. You are our administrative officer, Captain Dahlström, Lieutenant Dahlström. He was, before the war, in 1940, Norwegian consul in Bruges. So he had to escape over to England, of course. And he spoke fluent French, and also Dutch and English. And well, that day we had in the concentration area, he asked us, "Would you like to have a real French meal?" He said, "Yes, we were." And then he went to a small farm close to the camp there. And what those two had been talking about, I don't know. And one evening we went over to her house. We were told not to eat that day. And she served us the most delicious meal at that time, it shouldn't be very much better than the normal to be good for us, but it was fantastic. She showed us 5 dishes, salad, 4 dishes, and a meat, far among the thing I've tasted for years, and then fruit, of course, and things like that, and wine. And very, very normal housewife, farm wife, on a small farm. I think the farm she drove was most apples and so on that she had on the farm.
Did you come across the famous Calvados while you were?
Of course. It ended with Calvados.
Yes.
And we got a half a bottle each with us from her, you know. That was very, very... I remember that for a long time as one of the very good sort of... then the thing that happened to us that we never expected.
Had you had to adjust to English food while you'd been in Scotland and beyond, or were you on Norwegian rations?
No. There was no difficult whatsoever.
Yeah. No. So, but were you eating English rations, or were you on Norwegian rations?
No, we were in English rations all the time. Yeah, we were on English supply all the time.
Mm. And that was all right?
Yeah, of course it was all right, yeah. Mm. So, there was no difficulties whatsoever.
Mm. How did you get up to Bruges? What...
We went in a column with the Polish Armour Division. Ah. And when we came to Bruges, of course, we were taken as heroes.
Yes.
Because Dahlström was waited back into his town. He was belonged to the more or less active class in Bruges before the war.
Mm.
And I can tell you that in Bruges they have a very, very famous bow and arrow club.
Yes. Yes,
which is European famous, at least if not world famous.
Is this the crossbow club?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes,
and they had that sort of when we got up there middle of September, I think it was. They had their yearly club dinner, and we officers were invited, and they served everything from A to the bottom of the alphabet, and especially sort of the different types of alcohol, from the wine type to the beginning of the lowest or the easiest wine to the heaviest strong stuff. So when we were walking back to our billets, we had taken a sort of an atelier from the architect of what that we were living on. We lay on the floor on our camp beds, and we were six officers. And when we moved back, we went back on foot. We were in the condition that we shouldn't be able, and we shouldn't actually meet anyone we knew. And then have another extraordinary memory from that time. When we got back to the place we lived, then one of our officers called Rumutvet, he was later colonel, he died this summer, no? Last summer. He said that, could you please wait here, he said. And we all stood outside the door, and he went into the room. And in front of his bed, he always had a picture of his fiancée from Norway, in the long white rock. I think it was her confirmation dress. And he went in, he always had, wherever he went, the first thing he put that window in front of where he was going to sleep, and then he could go to put out his bed. And he went over to the place and took up this picture and he said something, and then he put it down with the right side down. And then he got in, and then he asked Daniel, he said, what did you say, Daniel? I said, yes, he said that her name was Louise. I didn't want, I told her that she shouldn't see the type of my fellows in this area. So you don't see what type of people I have as friends. So, and when he got home, he got married to Louise. Have four daughters, all living in Stavanger area. Yes, and we've got to Bruges. We started special training for Valkyren.
Did you know that you were going to Valkyren by that stage?
We had only been in Bruges for about a week when we officers were informed, together with the Belgian, which also was there, what was our task was going to be. And then outside Bruges, in Knokke, you know where that is?
Yes.
There was a battery, exactly like that battery on the beach in Westkapelle.
Well, the Germans built everything to a standard pattern, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yes.
And that battery was undamaged. And we were given that battery to start special training on the battery. They thought that our main task or the biggest difficulties when we land on the beaches in Westkapelle was to silence that battery, which was on our left-hand side when we got in, outside, on the outskirts of the landing beach. And we trained, we and the Belgians, we trained Belgians. One day we put the Norwegian troop, as defenders in the battery, and the Belgians attacked, and we chased around. And we did that day and every day for about a week. So we knew every canal in that battery. We knew every air canal. We knew all the different the ways in and out to the, you know, it was canals under
passages
under
the
ground, and so on. So we felt confident, you know, when we started later on to plan the attack on Westkapelle. We were very confident that this was going to be a fairly easy task for us to do.
Did you devise any new tactics or techniques to assist in taking the battery?
Yeah, you know that we knew it so exactly, that we knew exactly what point we were going to go for.
Yes.
And then after we've been doing this for the last 2 days, we were brought together with 41 Royal Marine Commando.
Yes.
Because the plan was that the main attack on Vulcan, of course, was, you know, that the fourth commander was going to attack by dawn on the Vlissingen side.
Yes.
But the main attack was going to come at Westkapelle, which was consisted of 41 Royal Marine Commando with Belgian and Norwegian troops of 10 commando, and then 47 and 48 Royal Marine Commando, which was going to land on the right-hand side of the gap and move south towards Vlissingen.
And the Dutch landed at Vlissingen, didn't they?
So a group of Dutch and a group of friends was with number 4 commando at Vlissingen.
Yeah.
And we were discussing and planning then with Royal Marine Commando, in 41 Royal Marine Commando. And the main plan was that Belgium was going to silence the water tower, because that was the observation place for the bombardment. And then we were going to move on left and on the left side of the battery, waiting for 41 Royal Marine Commando to come around and attack from the northeast. As soon as we got them into view from the northeast, we were going to open fire, and then we're going to take the battery.
Which point of the battery were you going to go for when you said you decided which way you were going to attack it?
From behind.
You're going to come in from the rear of the battery.
Yeah. We from the rear left, and the main attack from the Royal Marine Commando from the rear light, rear right. Mm. And then we embarked in Ostende around about midnight.
Another thing about the batteries, as I understand, is most of them had machine gun posts around them.
Yep.
Properly constructed machine gun posts. Often they were defended by mines. Did you have that problem to solve as well?
We thought of that, of course, but our plan was to go in under that without doing any taking any precautions towards the mine, because we thought that, you know, there was such a heavy, fantastic bombardment lay down on the area, but not only from the heavy ships from Warspite and the two monitors, but also from the rocket landing craft were going in and head of our going into the beaches. You know, there was they said they had 12 landing craft, which was 8 landing craft rockets and 4 landing craft guns.
Yes.
Which was moving in before we came in on shore. And the landing craft rockets was going to deliver all their rocks on the beach area.
So that would explode the mines?
First of all, exploding the mine, and it also will destroy the underwater obstacles along the water cant.
Right.
And then when those have been in there, so then the last 4 should be the rocket landing ships, rocket guns. He was going to shoot whatever they saw moved. Understand before we landed.
Right.
Well, that was a fantastic.
So you were going to have massive support.
Yeah. Yes. And that of course was because that the task was to capture Valkyren. Taking care of whatever it might cost. But it had to be done.
Done at all costs.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, did you think you were going to have heavy casualties as a result of
this? We thought of that also. There's another thing I will come into now, that is we were taking a Norwegian film from Valkyren by a Norwegian film photographer who was on my boat, actually. And the Norwegian troop moved in with most of the troop on one ship, and I with 18 men on another ship, together with the Belgians. And then the other part of the Belgians in the third ship. And when we moved in, and you see from the film, we were in the landing craft, we were embarked in buffaloes.
Yes.
So the plan was the buffalo was going to bring us over the difficult area into the beach. So you can see when the ships are coming, landing craft are coming in, we are standing up in the buffaloes and looking in towards the beach, even when the batteries grenades are exploded on the side of the ships. Mm. There was no fear whatsoever. You can see it on our face. There's nothing at all in there. It was, just
was there a fire coming back at you as you were going?
Yes, yes, oh yes, quite a lot of fire.
What sort of fire? Was it artillery?
Artillery.
Yes.
Artillery, yeah. And so, you know, when we started the movie, we were only about half an hour from the landing craft, when we can hear that the battleships group, the Borsbite group and their monitors moved, started their bombardment. And we could see the explosion along the seafront of the area. So that must have done fantastic lot of difficulty or damage that. So we moved in, and when we moved in, then we saw first the group of landing ship rocket. The first four came in forward, that turned the broadside to the shore and fired their rockets, most of them at least. The four ships disappeared from the sea, from direct threat. Hit from the land. Then the next four came out and moved in, and three of those disappeared. The fourth one went ashore out of control. And then came the last four, and two of those were also exploded.
Were those the hedgerows or the gun?
That was with the rocket. First three rockets.
Yes.
The first two rows were rockets, and then the third one was guns.
Yes.
And out of those 12 ships, landing crafts, only three survived. Mm-hmm. One laying on shore, out of control. Two came out and managed to move out. And then, of course, most of the personnel on those were living floating around in the sea. So we came in, and the other ship with the Norwegian trooper was a little bit forward to the side, and my ship was about that, together with the Benjamin. And we were preparing then to get ashore. I was repeating with one of the sergeants I was discussing, standing up it, and then we got the hit in the front. And that killed the bow crew, and the was impossible to open up.
What was it that had hit the front of the
artillery
shell?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we got one in the side. Mm-hmm. So we moved very slowly forward, and we decided we had no other chance. We had to jump.
How many of you were there in the Buffalo then?
We were in two Buffaloes.
Mm. But in your one that had been hit,
nine.
There were nine of you left.
Or nine in the other.
Yes.
And we had to leave the Buffaloes, of course, because the Buffalo couldn't get out. So we jumped the side, and we were so loaded down to the, as far as we could. We had planned that on this battery attack, we needed lots and lots of hand grenades.
Yes. I was going to ask if you were carrying explosives to blow your way into the battery through the door.
No, we had only hand grenades.
Yeah.
And we told everybody to take as many hand grenades as he think he could bring with him, not thinking that we were going to jump into the sea.
How many hand grenades did you have on your person?
I think it was eight or nine.
Eight. That's an awful lot of grenades to carry.
Yeah, yes, of course. They're heavy too.
And these are the standard Mills bombs.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then when we jumped, we touched bottom first, and then we can go a little bit. Then we had to sort of half crawl and half swim. But that was not the most difficult thing.
How far out were you when you abandoned the
Buffalo? I would say about 50, 60 meters.
Yeah, so you got about...
About 80 yards.
About 80 yards to get ashore.
Yeah, yeah.
And the water was...
Partly, we could move on the bottom because it was so heavily loaded.
Yes.
But what makes that very, very disheartening was that the sea where we had to go through was absolutely full of floating naval personnel from the boats. And I had a feeling that one was grabbing my underarm. Mm. I wasn't quite sure. I was so busy looking after what I should at that time, where my people, my boys were going to come on. And if I drew my hand to myself, and no, I don't know, but I dreamt many times about this thing, that if think probably if he was alive. But we got the.